From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, John Green, author of many popular young adult novels, including The Fault in Our Stars, which was adapted into a film. It's about a relationship between two teenagers with cancer. His latest novel, Turtles All the Way Down, features a teenager with OCD, which Green has too.
I get afraid of having an illness or having some kind of contamination inside of my body, and then I become unable to stop thinking about that, and the worry begins to consume me.
John and his brother Hank have a popular video blog called Vlog Brothers. Their followers call themselves Nerd Fighters. The brothers go on tour this month. Also, Justin Chang reviews the new film The Children Act, starring Emma Thompson as a family court judge. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, John Green, has a huge following, mostly among teenagers who are fans of his young adult novels. These books include The Fault in Our Stars, which sold over 23 million copies, was on the bestseller list for 24 weeks, and was adapted into a film. Green and his brother Hank also have a popular video blog called Vlog Brothers. And Hank's debut novel, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, will be published later this month. John Green's latest novel is called Turtles All the Way Down. It's about a 16-year-old named Asa still getting over the death of her father while also dealing with OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder. That leads to intrusive thoughts that get in the way of her day-to-day life and interfere with her relationship with her best friend and with her ability to have a boyfriend. Her particular obsession is with all the microorganisms that live on and in her body, and her fear that she will become infected with a deadly bacteria. John Green drew on his own experiences with OCD, which he's dealt with since childhood. Terry Gross spoke with John Green last year.
John Green, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start by reading from your new book, but first, since her obsession is fear of getting C. difficile, a.k.a. C. diff, why don't you describe what this really horrendous disease is?
Sure. C. diff is a disease that is usually associated with antibiotic use in hospitals, and it basically, there's this bacteria in your gut, and if it grows out of control, you can become very, very sick. And this is something that Asa worries about all the time, and she uses kind of compulsive behaviors, including checking the internet for symptoms to try to manage this worry that she has.
And just to get a little bit more graphic, I mean, C. diff leads to like really extreme diarrhea. And in some people, particularly in elderly people, you can die if it's not treated. So it's a very serious and a very problematic infection. And you're also going to refer in the reading I'm about to ask you to do to the microbiome, which is the collection of bacteria and microorganisms in the gut. And so the goal is to always have a healthy microbiome.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really weird things about being a person is that about half of the cells inside of your body are not yours, they're microbes. And that's also something that is of some concern to Asa, and for that matter, to me.
Oh, I know, it's a remarkable thing when you think about how your whole body, your skin, your gut, everything is just like populated with these microorganisms, which is scientifically fascinating, but the more you think about it, the kind of creepier it is. And for her, it's more than creepy. It's disturbing. It's very deeply disturbing. So I want you to do a reading, and this is from like a little more than midway through the book. And she has been friends with and is kind of starting to become girlfriend-boyfriend with a teenage boy. They're starting to kiss a little bit, and because of this whole microbiome thing, it's making her really uncomfortable. And some of what we're going to be hearing is her intrusive OCD, her obsessive-compulsive thoughts, interfering with the rest of her thoughts. So some of what you're saying is written in italics, and all the italicized parts are those intrusive thoughts interfering in her mind. Okay, would you do the reading?
I told myself to be in this moment, to let myself feel his warmth on my skin, but now his tongue was on my neck, wet and alive and microbial, and his hand was sneaking under my jacket, his cold fingers against my bare skin. It's fine. You're fine. Just kiss him. You need to check something. It's fine. Just be normal. Check to see if his microbes stay in you. Billions of people kiss and don't die. Just make sure his microbes aren't going to permanently colonize you. Come on, please, stop this. He could have Campylobacter. He could have non-symptomatic E. coli that you could get, and then you'll need antibiotics, and then you'll get C. diff, and boom, dead in 4 days. Please, just stop. Just check. Make sure. I pulled away. You okay? He asked. I nodded. I just need a little air. I sat up, turned away from him, pulled out my phone, and searched. Do bacteria of people you kiss stay inside your body? And quickly scrolled through a couple pseudoscience results before getting to the one actual study done on the subject. Around 80 million microbes are exchanged on average per kiss. And, quote, after six-month follow-up, human gut microbiomes appear to be modestly but consistently altered. His bacteria would be in me forever. 80 million of them, breeding and growing and joining my bacteria and producing God knows what. I felt his hand on my shoulder. I spun around and squirmed away from him, my breath running away from me, dots in my vision. You're fine. He's not even the first boy you've kissed. 80 million organisms in you forever. Calm down. Permanently altering the microbiome. This is not rational. You need to do something. Please, there is a fix. Please get to a bathroom. What's wrong? He asked. Nothing, I said. I just need to use the restroom. I pulled my phone back out to reread the study, but resisted the urge, clicked it shut, and slid it back into my pocket. But no, I had to check to see if it had said modestly altered or moderately altered. I pulled out my phone again and brought up the study. Modestly. Okay. Modestly is better than moderately. But consistently. I felt nauseated and disgusting, but also pathetic. I knew how I looked to him. I knew that my crazy was no longer a quirk. Now it was an irritation, like it was to anyone who got close to me.
Thank you for reading that. That's John Green reading from his new novel, which is called Turtles All the Way Down. So of all the obsessive compulsive thoughts you could have given your main character, Asa, why did you give her this obsession with C. diff?
Well, partly because I can relate to it. I mean, I needed a place where I could make a connection with Asa in order to write about her, I think. And I've long had a fear of contamination from microorganisms. That's long been one of the kind of focuses of my particular version of obsessive compulsive disorder. And so I think that was partly it. But also, it's something that we live with all the time. It's something that surrounds us, you know, like in a way, bacteria are overwhelming us. We are the dominant species on the planet until and unless you start considering bacteria.
So one of the things that she has are these thought spirals. I'm going to ask you to describe a thought spiral.
Well, the thing about a spiral is that if you follow it inward, it just keeps going forever. It just gets tighter and tighter, and it never actually ends. And that's kind of how Asa experiences her thoughts when she gets stuck into this kind of looping, turning, twisting series of thoughts about how she's definitely going to get C. diff and she's definitely going to die. And then she has to use these behaviors that she's developed to try to manage that fear. And there really is no way for her to pull out of the thought spiral. And that's part of what makes it so frightening to her, is that once she's in it, it doesn't feel like a thought spiral. It just feels like thought. It just feels like the way of the world. It feels like she's not wrong when she's afraid of this this infection or the other things that she fears. That's really terrifying. It's also really isolating for her because she struggles to be able to describe it with language. She struggles for the words that would help other people understand what she's going through.
She uses the word invasives to describe the kind of thoughts that you can't control and that take over. Is that your word, or did you get that from therapy?
I think it's my word. When I was first told about OCD, I was told that these thoughts are called intrusives, but I actually heard the word invasives for some reason, and that is what it's like for me. It's like there's an invasive weed that just spreads out of control. You know, it starts out with one little thought, and then slowly that becomes the only thought that you're able to have, the thought that you're constantly either forced to have or trying desperately to distract yourself from.
You sprinkle quotes from great writers throughout the book, and the opening quote is from the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. And the quote is, "Man can do what he wills, but he cannot will what he wills." Why has that such resonance for you?
I mean, that's my experience of being a person. Like, it's not so much the problem of free will, it's the problem of not being able to define my will. I mean, one of the things that Asa finds so scary in the book, and one of the things that I also have struggled with, is if these thoughts feel like they're coming from outside of me and I'm forced to have them and I can't choose my thoughts, then who exactly am I? You know, like, who's running the ship here? Am I really the captain of my consciousness, or is there some outside force that's shaping this for me. And so I'm not that interested in the question of free will, but I'm really, really interested in the question of how I experience some level of sovereignty over myself, I guess.
So at what point did you decide that you would write a novel with a main character who has, as you do, obsessive-compulsive disorder?
In some ways, the choice was made for me because I couldn't write about anything else. I tried to write a few other novels after The Fault in Our Stars came out, and I ended up having to abandon them. And then eventually, I got really sick, and coming out of that period of being really
OCD
unwell.
OCD sick?
Yeah, yeah. I just had a really poor period of mental health where for a few months I wasn't able to feel like I was in any control over what I was thinking about. And coming out of that period, this was kind of the only thing that I felt like I could write about. And so that became the story that I ended up writing.
So you've said that you have OCD. Tell us more about what form it has taken in your life.
Well, I guess the sort of dominant form that it's taken in my life is that I get worried, I get afraid of having an illness or having some kind of contamination inside of my body, and then I become unable to stop thinking about that, and the worry begins to consume me. And, in the face of that, you develop, or I have developed, compulsive behaviors to try to manage that and deal with that. But for me, it starts, there's a reason the O comes first in OCD. Like in the popular imagination, we always see people doing their compulsive behaviors because they're so visual and they're so often so strange and eccentric. But for me, it's the problem of my thoughts that is the problem. The compulsive behaviors are a way of trying to manage the kind of overwhelming fear that the obsessiveness causes me.
So what are the things you're most afraid of contaminating you?
I mean, there's I'm being super intentional about not saying that.
Oh, okay.
That's fine.
I don't want to.
Yeah, that's the only thing that I can't. I can't talk directly about it because I get squirmy.
You get what? Squirmy?
Yeah.
Would it be awkward too for us all to know, like, say we met you in person sometime? Would it be awkward for you to have everybody know what that most vulnerable point was?
Yes.
Yeah, understandable.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Green. He writes novels for young adults, and his most famous one is The Fault in Our Stars, which was adapted into a movie. Now he has a new young adult novel called Turtles All the Way Down. And I should mention, I think a lot of adults read your books, too. So we'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is John Green. He writes incredibly popular novels for young adults. His most famous one is The Fault in Our Stars, about a teenage girl and her teenage boyfriend who both have cancer. And the new book is called Turtles All the Way Down. And the main character in this is a teenage girl who has OCD, and so does the author John Green. So in the novel, there's a physical manifestation as well as obsessive compulsive thoughts. The physical manifestation has to deal with digging the fingernail of one finger into the finger pad of another. Would you describe that physical manifestation of OCD?
Yeah, so one of the ways, she's been doing this since she was a little kid, and she just digs her thumbnail into her finger pad. Initially, it was a way she would ask her mom, why do I know that I'm real? How do I know that I'm really real? And her mom would say, well, if you pinch yourself, you know it's not a dream. And so it began as that. It began as a way of feeling real. But over the years, it became kind of a locus of her obsession as well. And so this callus has developed on her finger pad. And now it's really easy for her to open up, to crack open that callus. And she gets worried that there's an infection underneath that callus. She covers it up with a Band-Aid because she's very embarrassed about it, but she often has to kind of open that up and try to drain the wound because she's worried that there's an infection there.
Of course, the more she does, the more she risks infection.
Of course, yeah. I mean, this is not uncommon. That like, these are not rational behaviors. So, you know, I find that like trying to apply logic, at least in my own life, like trying to apply logic to it is fairly ineffective.
So, have you had a physical manifestation like that too?
Yeah, not exactly that, but I count on my fingers as a way of calming myself, and so I think that's probably why I started thinking about it. And then I like the idea that, you know, it's literally affecting her fingerprint. You know, it's affecting who she is in a pretty profound way.
For Asa, your main character, the OCD leads to a form of self-obsession, which makes her self-absorbed and not tuned into other people. And her best friend calls her out for it. Her best friend basically says, "You probably don't even, you know." She lists things that she assumes Asa doesn't even know about her because she's so absorbed with herself. Was there a point in your life where you felt that your OCD was actually making you self-absorbed in a way that you didn't want to be, that you were neglecting other people, that you were losing a sense of empathy because you were looking within so much?
It has definitely affected my real-life relationships over the years in profound ways. I also wanted Asa to struggle with her ability to observe the world outside of herself because I think that is true to my experience, and it is not true to the kind of narrative of the obsessive detective that we have in the popular imagination. Obsessiveness is often linked to this like genius of observation that just is not my experience at all. Like I find that my OCD makes me a terrible detective.
Because you're focused on the wrong thing, obsessively.
Yeah, because I can't notice the world outside of myself in the way that I want to, because I'm so deeply and irrationally focused on stuff that's happening kind of within me.
The characters in your new book are also dealing with the deaths of parents. And in The Fault in Our Stars, the two main characters are dealing with cancer that is likely to be terminal. So, you know, death plays like a major role in your books, and I'd be interested in hearing why.
Well, I think it's a big problem. It's a big question. And I think one of the things I like about teenagers is that they're looking, yeah, I mean, it's a big theme. Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm concerned about it. That's probably one of the reasons. But also, one of the things I like about teen characters is that they're grappling with the kind of questions around death and the problems that death creates for the first time, sort of separate from their parents. And so they're asking, you know, is there an afterlife, and what are the implications for what we think about the afterlife? And they're asking, like, is meaning in human life changed by the fact of death? And I'm still really interested in those questions, and I like the way they approach them. Like, there's a lack of irony and a passion for those questions that I found really appealing when I was a teenager and that I still find really appealing.
When was the first time you dealt with the death of somebody who you knew?
When I was in high school, a classmate of mine died, and I went to a very small school, and it was devastating to the whole school.
How did the classmate die?
She was in a car accident.
What was your way of talking to your friends about it in order to get through it? Like, how did you... Do you remember any of those conversations in which you tried to talk through not only the loss that you were experiencing, but also, like, why do these things happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're in that position, those questions about meaning in life and what meaning you're going to find in life, they stop being rhetorical questions and they become matters of life and death. They become the questions that you need answers to if you're going to figure out how to go on. And so we had a lot of those conversations. You know, we had a lot of conversations where we were looking for meaning in life that could hold up against reality as we found it. And I've never found a lot of comfort in the straightforward answers to those questions, that like everything happens for a reason or that sort of answer. And I think that did start in high school, and it did start with those conversations with my friends.
Was there any kind of like religious service that provided answers that you either found comforting or, you know, just like bromides that were not helpful?
There were a lot of bromides that weren't helpful. I mean, I'm Episcopalian, and I worked briefly as a student chaplain at a children's hospital. You know, I thought about going to divinity school. Religion has been part of my life for a long time. But at the same time, I don't find the answers to those questions in my religious tradition, to be honest with you. Or at least not answers that satisfy me. I don't find a satisfactory answer for, you know, the problem of theodicy, as they call it in the world of religious studies, like the problem of evil in the world. I don't have a good answer for why there is so much deep, profound injustice in the world, and why, you know, the world behaves as if it were random. So if it isn't random, it's behaving as if it were.
Are you still Episcopalian? And if so, what do you find in your spiritual tradition?
I like going to church. I don't know that much about why, but yeah, I'm still Episcopalian. And I like the outward focus of it. I like turning outward for an hour each week. And I like the focus on service and, you know, the activism. Those parts of my church are really important to me.
Author John Green speaking to Terry Gross last year. After a break, we'll continue their conversation, and film critic Justin Chang reviews The Children Act, a new legal drama starring Emma Thompson. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, offering a way to buy home insurance with their Home Quote Explorer tool. Custom quotes and rates are available online. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. And from TIAA. TIAA is committed to helping those who are driven by purpose reach their definition of success. Investing, advice, banking, retirement. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview from last year with author John Green. He's famous for his young adult novels, including The Fault in Our Stars, which was about two teenagers with cancer who fall in love. His latest novel, Turtles All the Way Down, is about a 16-year-old girl who's still recovering from the death of her father and is afraid to have a relationship with a boy because of her OCD. Her particular obsession is with her microbiome, all of the bacteria and other microorganisms on and in her body. She lives in fear that she will get the intestinal infection C. diff, which can be life-threatening.
You know, as I mentioned in your last two novels, teenagers are dealing with death, death of their parents or the possibility of their own death because they have cancer. So you spent some time working as an assistant chaplain at a children's hospital? Is that what you said?
Yeah, a student chaplain, I think, is the technical term, but yeah, either way.
So what were you exposed to there?
You're with people on the worst day of their lives, and people who work in children's hospitals for longer than the few months that I was there are real heroes to me, because you see the worst things that can happen to people every day, and it was really difficult for me. I was not I couldn't do that work. I couldn't let it go. I still can't let it go 15 years later. And it was very hard.
Were you mostly
hard to see that?
Were you mostly talking with the parents or the children?
Mostly with the parents, but I did hang out a lot with some teenagers who were sort of there long term for various chronic health problems. Mostly playing video games, to be honest. I was 22
probably really
at the time.
Helpful.
Yeah, and so if somebody had an Xbox, I would play video games with them.
Did it feel awkward to be 22 and trying to help parents through a period when their child was you know, dying or possibly dying? Did you feel like, who am I to help them? I'm 22.
Yeah, of course I did. Yeah, I felt unqualified in every possible way. But, you know, interestingly, I'm now 40, and I think I would still feel unqualified in every possible way.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I might be worse at the job now. I think I was a pretty poor chaplain all those years ago, but I think I would be much worse at it now, because now that I have, I just think that I would identify more, and it would be even more difficult for me to, you know, to be there for people in the way that they need when they're in that situation.
Because you're a father now?
Yeah.
Are you surprised that so many teenagers want to read stories about teenagers who have the kind of problems that make you feel different from everyone else, like OCD, or like having lost a parent who died, or like having cancer and maybe dying yourself? I mean, so many teenagers are just absorbed with, you know, school, finding a new boyfriend or girlfriend, just like having friends, figuring out how to make your way without being bullied or hated by other kids. But I mean, you're dealing with really major problems in your book. Not to make light of those other problems, because when you're a teenager, those other problems are really big.
Right. No, I think that's actually the answer, though, is that when you're a teenager, no matter what your experience is, the problems are big, and they're in many cases new. In many cases, it's the first time you've had this problem. So, you know, when I fell in love with my wife, you know, we have a great, awesome marriage. But I was also like, this is like the other times I fell in love. Like, I understood what was happening to me. But when I fell in love for the first time, I was like, what is this completely unprecedented thing that has never existed in human history before? And so I think there's, you know, that intensity to the firstness of all these experiences that teenagers are going through, I think is part of what makes them connect to people who feel who are going through really unusual experiences.
Do you remember your first girlfriend, your first crush, and can you tell us about it, or would you rather not?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, my first crush was in third grade, and I wore, like, matching OP, like, shorts and a shirt to ask her to go with me, which was the parlance of the day. And I remember, like, you know, just feeling so incredibly nervous, as if the stakes were actually high and I wasn't 9 years old, and asking her to go with me. And she said yes. And I was like, this is incredible. But then I had no idea, like, what the next step was, you know, like, I had no idea, like, how do we proceed from here? So we eventually exchanged phone numbers and had a few phone conversations over the next few weeks. And then I don't think there was ever an official breakup. I think it just was sort of understood that this wasn't going to end in marriage.
Did you tell your parents?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely told my parents. I was like, I have a girlfriend. And they were like, why?
Did you kiss?
No. I don't even think we held hands, actually.
So what did it mean to have a girlfriend?
Nothing. I mean, yeah, I think it must have been born from the stories I was reading. Like, I was really into, like, series books like Sweet Valley High and The Babysitter's Club. And so it must have come from those stories that, like, this is what you do. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a try.
Do you remember the first time you fell in love for real?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was in college.
Did the OCD get in the way of that?
It got in the way of it in the sense that it's really difficult, I think, for anyone who is close to someone who's in terrible psychic pain to be near that pain for a lot of reasons. One, you want to take it away. Two, it's just difficult. And so it was a problem, especially we dated for a few years, and I think it was a problem, especially at the end of our relationship, because I would lose a lot of myself, my ability to pay attention to the world outside of myself, to these, you know, thought spirals, and I wouldn't be able to pull myself out of it enough to be a good partner or to be a good friend even. And that was definitely a problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Green. He writes novels for young adults. The new one is called Turtles All the Way Down, and it's about a girl with obsessive-compulsive disorder. His previous book is the bestseller, The Fault in Our Stars, which was adapted into a film. We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering immunotherapy and other personalized treatment options to address patients' individual needs. More about precision cancer treatment at cancercenter.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is John Green. He writes novels for young adults. He's best known for The Fault in Our Stars, which was adapted into a film. His new novel is called Turtles All the Way Down, and it's about a teenage girl with OCD. The Fault in Our Stars, the one where it's written from the point of view of a teenage girl who has, is it stage four, I think, cancer.
Yeah.
My understanding is that's based in part on one of your fans who actually was dying of cancer.
Yeah, my friend Esther Earle, she died of cancer in 2010 when she was 16, and she was a really involved member of the community that grew up around the videos that my brother and I made, and was really involved in our charity projects and became a friend of mine. And she died in 2010. And I kind of wrote The Fault in Our Stars mostly in the 2 years after her death.
What were some of the things you took away from her life and death that you put in the book?
Esther was just uncommonly empathetic. I don't know that was because she was sick. I think it was partly because she was, you know, some people are just extraordinary. She was incredibly, in the same way that Aza can't pay attention to the world outside of herself, Esther was extremely tuned in to the world outside of herself. You know, the other question, I guess, that emerged for me in the wake of Esther's death was whether a short life can still be a good and a fulfilling life. And I needed to feel like it could be, you know, I needed to feel like Esther had a good life. And I wrote the book in some ways, I think, in that hope, almost like a prayer that a short life can still be a good life.
Did writing the book convince you?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that writing the book convinced me, but I do believe that.
You have two children. Is your point of view when you're writing shifting a little bit from the teenager to the parent? I mean,
yeah.
the parent in the new novel is very, I find her a very sympathetic character. I mean, she clearly, like, loves her daughter so much and is trying so hard not to be the intrusive parent, you know, to have the right amount of connection and distance. But, you know, it's always hard to find. And as Asa says to her at one point, Asa says to her mother, I'm doing my best, but I can't stay sane for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think as parents, we desperately want to take pain away from our kids. And we want to, I want to save my kids from all the hurt that the world has in it. And you can't. And there's that's so difficult. It's so hard to reconcile yourself to that. I do think that I have become much more interested in parents as characters since I became a parent. Like, I used to shuffle all the adults out of my books as quickly as possible. And now I'm like, hold on a second. Let's listen to your mother first. Your mother might have a point here. And I do think that is probably a result of this change in my life that has caused me to suddenly be tremendously sympathetic to the parental point of view.
And your kids aren't even teenagers yet.
No, God, no. They're 7 and 4. So I have a long, long way to go.
I want to quote something that Asa, your teenage character, says in the book, or thinks in the book. I hated my body. It disgusted me. Its hair, its pinpricks of sweat, its scrawniness, skin pulled over a skeleton, an animated corpse. I wanted out of my body, out of my thoughts, out. But I was stuck inside of this thing, like all the bacteria colonizing me. Is this a feeling you understand of, like, hating your body and feeling kind of disgusted by it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for much of my life, I felt like I had to carry around this skin-encased bacterial colony in order to have a mind and a consciousness, you know? And also, I've often felt like my body is trying to control my consciousness or dictating what I can think about or what I can feel. And that feels really frustrating. I have to say that in the last few years, I've come around to the body a little bit, partly through exercise, partly through cognitive behavioral therapy techniques. And I don't see my body anymore as the opposite of me. But I do still feel at times frustrated by the fact that I'm stuck inside of just this one vessel, you know? So I don't know. I'm very grateful for my body now. But at the same time, I do rather wish that, you know, like, it could go on forever and never hurt.
Sure, and there's times you probably want to trade in your brain also, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, there's probably more times when I want to trade
thoughts
in my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, to be completely honest, like, it'd be great to be able to, like, turn my brain into the mechanic and, like, have them just, like, fix some stuff up and then give it back to me. That
yeah.
would be great.
So I read that you said you were bullied when you were in, I don't know, junior high or high school. Anything in particular you were bullied for, you know, that you were mocked for?
I mean, I don't really know. They don't seem to need a great reason.
They don't tell you as they're reading you up?
Right, yeah. That would have been nice, though, if they could have, like, sent a note that just explained, like, here are the 3 things you're being bullied for. And if you could work on these 3 things, then we'll stop. I think I was different. I was very nerdy. I struggled socially partly because I was really stuck inside of myself. And I think I was at times kind of an annoying kid, because I was, you know, a little obsessive and perpetually nervous, but none of that justifies the bullying that happened. It was difficult. And the middle school years especially were extremely difficult for me. And I did have friends, and I was very grateful for those friends, but the bullying was scary and difficult.
Did you fight back?
No. This is going to surprise you, Terry, but I'm not really super able to fight back.
I never would have expected that.
Yeah, I'm not a boxer.
So explain what nerd fighters are and what that expression means to you, and do you wish you had that expression when you were a teenager?
Yeah, nerd fighters are people who fight for nerds and fight for nerd culture. It's the term used by people who are in the community that grew up around the videos Hank and I make. And I do wish that I'd had a community like that when I was a kid. I hope that that community for a lot of young people can be a way of connecting with people who may not live in the same place as them, but who have the same interests as them, and so they can feel, you know, not alone in their enthusiasm for Harry Potter or science or whatever it is. And Yeah, I do wish I'd had a community like that as a kid. And I hope that our community can be that for some people. But I also think that there's still a lot of bullying among kids these days. And because of cyberspace, there's no way to be free from it because people can always reach you through your phone or through your computer. And that's really scary. And I hear every day from kids who feel really alone and really afraid because there's no break from the bullying.
Right. But on the bright side, you could do your video blog with your brother and have these like 3 to 4 minute kind of funny segments about everything from OCD to, you know, like what is the meaning of life to like science and math and history and literature.
Yeah, I mean, making these videos with my brother has been like one of the great joys of my professional life. And I'm still one of Hank's first viewers. He uploads a video every Friday. And I'm still one of the very first people who watches it every Friday. He just made a video about the world's largest fruits. So it's true that a lot of them are very serious, but I thought his video about the world's largest fruits was just amazingly funny. Yeah, I'm such a fan of my brother, so it's really fun to be able to collaborate with him. I mean, I'm currently on a bus with my brother for the next month, so we're very close. But
you're touring,
also, even
touring.
When I, yeah.
So what are your shows like when you're touring with your brother?
Oh, it's a little bit of a variety show. Hank plays songs about science. He plays music. And the vibe we're going for is like, you know, old school variety show vibe.
Okay. No jugglers or anything.
No jugglers. Maybe down the road, you know. Maybe we'll pick somebody up along the way.
And when did you realize you wanted to write?
Well, I always liked writing, but I thought of it like being an astronaut or being a professional athlete or something. I never thought of it as a realistic career goal. And in some ways, I still have a day job, and I like having a day job. I like going into the office in the afternoon and working on the online video stuff that we make. But after I decided not to go to divinity school, I started working at this magazine called Booklist. I was a assistant there, mostly doing data entry. But Booklist reviews like 400 books every 2 weeks, and all those books were written by somebody. And so that's when I started to feel.
But were they
like,
read
well,
by
maybe...
anybody is the question.
not all of them, certainly. But that's when I started to feel like, okay, well, it's not quite like being a professional athlete or being an astronaut. Like, this is something that regular people do. Lots of people write books. And that's when I started to feel like maybe I could write a book. And at the same time, I started reading a lot of young adult books. And I really loved them. And I thought, well, that would be a great place. Like, that would be such a cool place to publish. And so when I was writing my first novel, I was kind of hoping that's where it would end up, and it did.
Why were you starting to read a lot of young adult books then?
I think partly because I was the youngest person at Booklist, so I was the closest thing they had to a young adult.
They asked you to read the young adult books.
Yeah, yeah, I also think...
So you were reviewing young adult fiction and then decided you wanted to write it too.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did that seem like a good fit?
Well, I mean, there are a bunch of reasons, I think. I like the way that young adult books are published. I like that science fiction and mystery and romance all live on the shelf together, you know, that they're the genre separations that you see in books for grown-ups aren't there in the same way. Also, YA books tend to hang around because of support from librarians and teachers, and that was really appealing to me. But in terms of character and readers, it's a privilege to have a seat at the table in somebody's life when they're forming their values. And that's, for me, what my experience was as a teen reader. And, you know, I hope that my books can be part of that conversation for teen readers today.
John Green, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Novelist John Green speaking to Terry Gross last year. This fall, John will be joining his brother, Hank Green, on the book tour for Hank's first novel, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, which will be published later this month. Coming up, film critic Justin Chang reviews The Children Act, a new legal drama starring Emma Thompson. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The prize-winning English author Ian McEwan recently adapted two of his novels for the screen. The first film, On Chesil Beach, was released earlier this year. The second film, The Children Act, is a new legal drama starring Emma Thompson. She plays a family court judge trying to determine whether a minor can be forced to undergo a blood transfusion against his will. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The Children Act refers to a 1989 piece of British legislation that requires authorities to promote the welfare of minors, first and foremost. But in Ian McEwan's 2014 novel, and now this polished, absorbing, if somewhat perplexing movie adaptation, determining a child's best interest is never as clear-cut as it seems. Fiona May, an esteemed high court judge played by a superb Emma Thompson, understands this difficulty better than most. Her every moment is consumed with bitter custody battles, grim medical dilemmas, and other quandaries that threaten to tear families apart, and she brings to each ruling a lifetime's worth of expert discernment. One of the pleasures of the novel was how deeply it brought us into the intricacies of Fiona's legal reasoning, such as her decision to order a pair of conjoined twins to be separated. Is it lawful for the state to demand an operation that will save one boy but end his brother's life? And what of the twins' Catholic parents, who would prefer to leave the matter in God's hands? The book argued persuasively for every possible side before allowing Fiona to render her judgment with Solomon-like authority. Although McEwan himself wrote the script, the movie doesn't have as much time to delve into the nuances of each argument. For all its measured intelligence and solid craftsmanship, The Children Act never fully springs to cinematic life. As crisply directed by Richard Eyre, who has roots in the English theater, it gives the creaky impression of having been adapted from a stage play. Still, it's always rewarding to watch Thompson bring her lucid wit and deep reserves of emotion to bear on Fiona as she puzzles over the toughest case of her career. That case involves a 17-year-old named Adam Henry, who has leukemia and requires a blood transfusion. But Adam comes from a family of Jehovah's Witnesses, and he has refused the transfusion based on his belief that God forbids the intermixing of blood. But because Adam is still just months shy of adulthood, it falls to the court to decide his fate. After hearing both sides, Fiona takes an unusual step before making her decision.
Given the unique circumstances of this case, I have decided I would like to hear from Adam himself. I need to know if he understands his situation and what he confronts, should I rule against the hospital. I'll go now to Adam's bedside in the company of his guardian. I'll give judgment in open court when I return, probably after 7 p.m.
Court rise.
Whether a judge would actually pay such a hospital visit raises some plausibility issues, which the gravely ill Adam himself acknowledges. He's startled and captivated by the sight of Fiona suddenly at his bedside. As played by Finn Whitehead, who made a strong impression last year in Dunkirk, Adam is irreverent yet serious-minded, with a love for reading and writing poetry. Their visit ends in charmingly preposterous fashion, with Adam playing an old Irish folk song on his guitar, while Fiona, herself a talented musician, sings along. I won't give away Fiona's ultimate judgment, or the intriguing, if not entirely persuasive, direction in which it takes the story. To its credit, The Children Act has no intention of resolving the conflict between medical expertise and religious principles. McEwan's larger point seems to be that when it comes to something as essential as a child's well-being, no jurist can be entirely dispassionate. That even goes for Fiona, a consummate workaholic whose husband, played by Stanley Tucci, has just announced his intention to have an affair with one of his younger colleagues, citing Fiona's emotional and sexual neglect. Their contentious back and forth rather too neatly underscores one of the movie's central ideas, the folly of trying to impose order on something as unruly as human emotion. The film plays on the irony of a woman regularly intervening in the lives of children, despite having always been too career-focused to have children herself. There's a whiff of sexism to that notion, but Thompson is a shrewd enough actress to liberate Fiona from any second-rate psychology. Some of the movie's sharpest scenes unfold in her offices, where she snaps at her assistant and endures a colleague's annoying jokes. We register the stress that comes with processing human lives day in and day out, even as Fiona delivers judgments whose consequences she will almost certainly never see. It's a sobering reminder that behind every juicy courtroom drama, the wheels of a heavy bureaucratic machinery turn and turn. And sadly, the lives of our youngest and most vulnerable sometimes wind up getting caught in the gears.
Justin Chang is a film critic at the LA Times. On Monday's show, Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book is about the unspoken alliance between astrophysics and the military. He says the Trump administration's plan to create a space force, taking over what the Air Force already is doing in space, isn't crazy. But he'd add a few other things.
I'd throw in, hey, why don't you defend this against asteroid strikes? And how about cleaning up the space garbage?
Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Sam Brigger. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our associate producer for digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Maine Office of Tourism, offering travelers an opportunity to explore and discover their very own Maine thing, to be inspired, be original, and be yourself at visitmaine.com. And from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaboration meeting platform allowing people to connect around the globe to get work done. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.